right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Be the Right Club Today podcast. You know, we've done a lot of podcasts on practice. How do we get better? How do we take what we've been working on the practice tee to the golf course, skill development, skill transfer, all that stuff. And we decided to get one of the world's leading experts on skill development, Dr. Will Wu. Dr. Will Wu is the professor of motor learning and control at the Long Beach State University. He's also the co-founder of the Skilled Coaching Alliance with our good friend, Mr. John Dunnigan. Dr. Will, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you both.
Dr. Will, I'm curious. Tell us what motor control learning is and how does it fit into golf?
Well, it's funny you ask that because, you know, when people ask my mother what it is I actually do, she still kind of has no idea. So I think that's a really important, question to ask. In the most simplest way, it's how we produce and control movements, and then how we learn movements and then refine movements we already know. In the golf world, the definition is how do we learn components of the golf swing within a lesson? And then how do we practice it away from the lesson? And all with the lens of being able to produce it when it counts, which is a tournament or competitive situation. And over the years, I think people have probably conceptualized practice as the more time you spend, the more committed and the more effortful and the more reps that you take in practice, the better that you're going to be. And I think those are all extremely important foundational things associated with practice. But in the years of research that we have, there are definitely ways that you can take the commitment and the amount of practice that you do and organize it in a way where it actually comes out better in competitive or tournament situations.
So, Doc, what do you think, you worked with a bunch of tour players, what do you think like guys like Hal did that amateurs don't do? You know, because a lot of, you know, guys like Hal play the game at the highest level, one of the best players to ever play. Some of them figured out the practice stuff on their own without ever really knowing it. What do you see? What are some of the characteristics, some of the traits that you know, guys like Hal and some of the greatest to ever play do right and versus the regular amateur, what do they do wrong?
Yeah, so I don't want to discount the contributions of mom and dad. So really elite players or performers are always a byproduct of what mom and dad gave them genetically. And I think from a motor control and learning standpoint, you can never get away from a discussion of motor abilities. And motor abilities are the genetic traits that people are born with. And so a lot of the times that separates the very elite from the people that never got to Hal's level. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're automatically going to be elite players. They're automatically going to be good. There are things that they figured out along the way that make them really good. And so if you kind of think about skill development, how people's skills manifest themselves in terms of their careers and successes, I think the first layer needs to be someone's ability or someone's motor ability, right? The genetic traits that allow them to be good movers that they are. I think the next thing is you have to have a certain level of commitment, effort, repetition, and time devoted to it. And then on top of that, as you mentioned, people figure things out along the way. There was no research at the time or far less research at the time when Hal was growing up. And so good players figure it out. Good coaches kind of figure it out and stumble upon it. And I always, you know, always talk about what John Wooden did before motor control was really formalized in terms of the research and how it was helping athletes and in the real world, so to speak, because it was really just kind of military pilots that it started out with. It was very a small section of society. But I just look at kind of the stories of John Wooden, and they a lot of the times they talk about how John Wooden wouldn't be like such a demonstrative in-game coach. He kind of sat down quite a bit, not to say he didn't coach during games, but much less than other people. And they asked him why he did that. And he said, because I'm evaluating what we're going to work on in practice after the game. And I think that's an extremely important viewpoint, because obviously he's trying to win the game, and obviously helps that he has Walton Abdul-Jabbar and all those greats to help him win the game, and maybe he can afford to do something like that. But I think the perspective of there's a difference between training and practice performance and game time performance. And if you go into training and practice situations with that general lens, it will really guide you and open your eyes in terms of what you should or should not be doing. And so I really appreciated the fact from a motor control and learning standpoint that he was using the game as an assessment to structure what he's doing in practice. And then it's ultimately what we should be doing with golf, or what I encourage the players that I work with golf. Like my two kids are junior golfers, and my oldest, my son, I always say, at this age, we're just using tournaments as assessments for what we want to work in training. And if you work on the right things, and if you train and practice well, then they'll come about in tournament situations. And so I think a lot of the times people have figured it out. They don't necessarily know or they didn't have the research back then, but they kind of stumbled upon it, figured it out. And some people just have very kind of good perspectives on how to view both. And so I'd imagine that's what happened with Hal, and kind of how he was coached or how he's instructed and what he was doing.
Wow, thoughts? Well,
it's been so long ago, I don't know if I can remember what I did. But, you know, I know this. My goal was to out-practice everybody that I, you know, played golf with. And, you know, just by learning the game and becoming more experienced in the game, I knew what I needed to work on. And, you know, last week dictated what I was going to work on the next week. And, you know, I say on here all the time, and I'm sorry for repeating myself, I never saw anybody make their weakness their strength. I saw people lose their strength trying to make their weakness their strength. You know, to me, my strength was always my strength, and I needed it. Every day I went out, I needed what I did best. I needed to, and you see that in all walks of sport. I think you would probably agree with that. And, you know, when Curry's not shooting three-pointers as well as he normally does, he's not quite the basketball player that he would normally be. And that's pretty true across all sports. Yeah. So,
yeah, I think you in that two things popped out in what you explained there is I think you said learning how to play golf. And I think what we have in this day and age of golf, it's a really exciting time. So I just kind of look at what you have in your academy and the technology that you have in your academy, and other academies are just maybe other homes. Like, I mean, a lot of individual players have their own launch monitors now. And so technology has afforded us the ability to see things we couldn't see before. But I think the downside of that is what I've noticed is golf has probably become a little bit more like gymnastics, where there's a little bit too much emphasis on how it looks or how people are swinging. And like you mentioned, golf is not gymnastics, it's an outcome-based activity. So learning how to play golf, which you mentioned, that's really critical, because you can swing it and it not look so well, good, but if you can get that ball in the hole, if you know how to play golf, then it's a different story. And so I think it's kind of a balance, right? It's how we, and JD or John Dunnigan kind of probably spoke about this when you had him on, is you have to be able to use the technology in the right way. And just because you've refined the swing, you've optimized the swing, optimized distance, made consistency a little bit better, you still have this other animal of learning how to play the game of golf. And I think what you mentioned, learning how to play golf, is really important. And that's it. And that's when we talk about practicing, a lot of things that I encourage more so for my really high level players is what I like to call scrimmage. And scrimmage all takes place on the golf course. In scrimmage, there's a complete spectrum and a world of ways that you can design scrimmage based around what the play, what part of the game the player is working on, or even what part of the swing the player is working on. But when you're allowed to practice in the environment that you're competing in, the learning environments become that much more rich. Like if you think about it from the standpoint of, let's say, football, basketball, baseball, think about their training and practice environments, where they occur. They occur on the football field, they occur on the basketball court, and they occur on the baseball field. In golf, if we think about a practice environment, we typically think about a driving range, a practice green, or the short game area. They're actually different from the actual competitive environment of the course. And so if you just kind of think about that inconsistency, it opens up a world of opportunities until in terms of how you're going to devote your time in practice and the types of things that you're practicing within those training contexts. And so I think that's really important that you mentioned that, Hal, is because learning how to play golf is very, very different from learning the swing of golf. You brought up another super point that comes up, a very important point that comes up all the time, especially with really high level players, is they get to a certain level because of something. And then usually the coaches that I work with, the other practitioners, like within the team, within a team for a player, we always use the term superpower. Like you had a superpower. Rory has a superpower, right? The players that I work with have superpowers, and those superpowers got them to that level. It could be whatever it is, any part of the game that allows them to be where they are. It could be just they're really good putters. They're like Colin Morikawa, really good iron player, or it could be distance off the tee, but there is a superpower. It could be a specific shot shape, right? They're really good at hitting the shot shape and they can produce it at almost any time, right? So that could be a superpower. So a lot of it in these kind of team high level elite performance situations is understanding what the superpower is, making sure that you don't go away from the superpower, and then adding additional tools to where maybe the shot shape doesn't work for a particular hole. So have they developed the appropriate skills where they can go in and grab another tool from the toolbox, right? That's different, but still on relying on what got them there. And so those are really important points that really don't get discussed when you talk about skill development in the game of golf or really much a variety of sporting activities.
Well, one of the things when you were talking about all that, I used to go out on the golf course in the morning and I would take 3 or 4 balls and put it in my pocket and I'd play the hole from different areas all the time instead of actually going out on the practice tee. After I finished that, then I would go work on something on the practice tee. But I wanted to see how I did in the environment of golf. I wanted to be a player, not a swinger. I saw a lot of swingers. I wanted to be a player. And there's a difference between the two. Sometimes they're one and the same.
Yeah.
But not always.
Yeah. I mean, just aesthetically, if you go in, you go to a Korn Ferry event, which is, I mean, those guys ball on the Korn Ferry tour. But if you were just go to a Korn Ferry event, look at players swinging on the range, and then go to a PGA tour event, look at players swinging on the range. If you were just had no idea who the main players in golf were, you would look at all those swings and go like, man, all those guys are really good. They look pretty similar in their ability to hit the ball. But there's a difference in what you say is playing the game of golf. Like the elite players have gained the swing, and they also been able to successfully navigate how to play the game and do things at certain points or not do things at certain points. And in your description, it's kind of how I think about the driving range. Is the driving range is like a lab. It's to confirm some ideas. But if you want to test it, the driving range can fool you into thinking you're better than you really are, or thinking that you're worse than you really are. And so that's what I meant by earlier. It's kind of like having the lens of what practice is for and what tournaments are for, and using the course or competitive play as the assessment. And so you just kind of use the range or practice area. I like in general, and it kind of changes the distribution for the level of player. But if we're talking about higher level players, it's like, okay, use the range to kind of explore a little bit, what I call calibrate a little bit, get some idea, warm up, but the work is done on the course, and you should be evaluating yourself how you're doing on the course, or your skill level on the course rather than the range. And I'm sure you've heard all the time, and we hear this, it's a professional player would say, I just had the worst range session, and then I go out and play and they shoot a really low score. It's a really good example of your range performance is not indicative of your actual skill, because it's a very artificial environment.
So Doc, you mentioned superpowers and you know, how mentioned about, you know, turning strengths into, or weaknesses into strengths and whatnot. How do you take, so we like to talk to, say, a 10 handicap comes in, and we like them to assess and take an inventory of their game and say, okay, I'm a 5 handicap when it comes to driving, but I'm a 15 handicap when it comes to short game. So then driving's their superpower at the moment because it's twice as good as everything else. What comes to mind when I say, okay, we've got a player that, you know, struggles with a short game, could be elite, could be a higher handicap. How do they go about, you know, changing the motion, implementing the motion, going into the scrimmage? You know, I've written down technique versus skill development, because a lot of times it starts as a technique and then turns into developing the skill to transfer it over to the course. But where does your brain go? How do you assess that? How do you implement that?
So one of the things I like about my job, at least in the consulting world, is that I always say, whenever I work with a coach or a player, I always say, I'm not a coach, right? I've never professed myself as a swing coach. So how that translates is, you know, I work a lot with Mark Blackburn, and we have this terminology where we call it ingredients and recipes. And so I always say, I don't know the ingredients, but coaches give me the ingredients and I make the recipe for practice. And the ingredients are really large in part by what are the technical things that needed or you all want to change in the swing, and what parts of the game that you want to focus on. And so I have the luxury to be able to say that's not necessarily my department, because it's really not. But I think on a general landscape of how we know that people get better at motor skills is oftentimes you need to address large movement discrepancies. And in the really knowledgeable coaches that we see, it's a part of their algorithm to begin with, right? And when coaches start to separate each other from one another, it's knowing when to move on from the technical aspects to the skill aspects of things. And so usually when I get players, whether it be, you know, amateur players who are super motivated or professional players, I'm always asking, okay, what does your coach want you to work on? And that question, there's a lot in that question, because it's where they are within the existing process of their experience with their coach. It could be something maybe an amateur, it could be very movement related, right? Which are the gross things that you want, are the big things that you want to fix. And then for the higher level players, those technical things may be a little bit smaller. And they can overcome those a lot better just because of the talent level that I mentioned before, and it is their job. And so they have a lot of opportunity and reps to do it, and they have a lot of experience and knowledge behind it. So they can overcome some of these deficiencies a lot faster. And then it goes to kind of like some skill training to an extent. So I guess the cop-out answer on my part, or the general answer on my part, is a lot of the times I don't need to make those decisions, because those decisions come from the coach, or they come from the player. And I get the ingredients for them. And then once I know the ingredients on what they want to work on, what part of the game they want to work on, whether it be what I call the gymnastics part, that's all the movement part, or whether it be called the skills part, like the in on course, in tournament stuff, I can create a recipe based upon whatever ingredients I'm giving them. And I like that analogy a lot, because you can have the best recipe, right? Best recipe for practice, the best recipe for training. But if the ingredients aren't good, right? You don't get the optimized or maximized performance. And so the ingredients need to be good. What you're working on needs to be appropriate and accurate for that player at that specific amount of time. And so I like that analogy a lot, because it really shows the interplay of the importance of between how people should be moving and how you should train how they're moving, right? And it's very different from what you do in a coaching setting. I don't know if you've heard me say this before, Chase, but how what I'll always say is learning doesn't happen in the lesson, right? I mean, some people will kind of look at me and go, what? And I'm like, learning doesn't happen in a lesson. It's like I have university students that I teach. And we'll take my intro to motor control and learning class. There's 180 students in that class. I meet with them 2 hours a week. It's not a learning environment per se, right? When does the learning occur? Learning occurs when they study, right? So what my situation becomes is it's an exchange of information, but I have to exchange the information in a way that is very clear for them so they can go on and study it. So I look at an instructional environment with coaching sports, or more specifically golf, is if you look at it as an exchange of information, then it sets you up well. Because when you look at it that way, then you need to say to yourself, well, I need to exchange this technical information to this player, and I'm not going to see him for a week. So what I say to them and how they understand what we're trying to work on, they have to be able to understand in a way that they can practice it for an entire week. So when they come back a week later, you're not, what have you been doing for a week? so there's an exchange of information. That's the coaching part within the 1 hour lesson or 2 hour lesson. And then there's all that stuff that happens in between that coaching session and the next session. And that's the practice training. That's where the learning occurs. And so that's that big distinction, or that's that big, big picture view that I mentioned with John Wooden before, that can kind of change the way you go about doing things. That it changes how you go about instructing the player within that coaching environment. If you say they have to learn, they have to remember, it could be the feels, it could be the instructions, it could be the cues, whatever it may be, but you have to think about, they have to remember this 4 days from now. So if you're super biomechanically technical in the way you coach, like what are the odds on a 14-year-old girl competitive remembering that 4 days from now, right? That's assuming she takes a lesson every week. What happens if she just takes a lesson every 3 weeks, every 2 weeks? And so then what that does is forces demand on the coach and says, wow, okay, I just did an analysis and all the analysis tools are awesome, but now I need to translate all this information to where 4 or 5 days from now, they can remember it is what I want them to do, or make it, or even this way. What happens if they're in the tournament setting, right? And they need to be managers of their own movements or their own swings within the game context. Are they going to be able to, muster it or to remember it? And so those creating those distinctions will kind of change the way you view things. It'll change the way you practice. It'll change the way you teach. And for like the players, like if you're a student and you're looking for coaches, how I always look at, and this is how I look at it for my kids, right? When they're looking for instruction, I'm looking for at, are they going to be able to remember this stuff? Right. And that's the key thing. And I think as a student looking for a coach, that's your return on investment, right? Is the value of, I can remember this stuff when I'm on the range practicing by myself. How they're practicing is a completely different thing, but just the information itself, can they remember it in the same way that you want them to remember it, right? And so I think that's really important. As a coach, it completely changes the language that you speak to them. I had the opportunity to interact with Mike Adams and his students, you know, in the early, very early part of my my kind of consulting career within the golf industry and domain. And the very first time, I'm like, in my mind, I'm always doing like these checklist assessments, these motor learning assessments of coaches. And the funny thing is, he teaches a student, we get in the car and we're going back to his house. And as soon as he gets in the car, he looks at me and goes, "How'd I do?" Like he knew I was evaluating him. And honestly, like 99% of what he did was really good. And so that's like an illustration of kind of what you referred to earlier, is like some coaches are able to figure it out. And when they're able to figure it out, their students get really good. But how he spoke to the students, I looked at the analogies that he gave the students, how he used the technology to translate to the students, really good in terms of how they're able to take that information with them when he's not around. And so what we say, how we get people to train, is really important in the coaching environment, because it influences all the hours that they're practicing away from you. And they practice more, they're swinging the golf club disproportionately more without your supervision than under your supervision. And so you cannot be there for all your players. And so how you can be there is how you're setting up that instructional environment and how you're creating some momentum to how they're going to practice and train. And that could be just how you're speaking to them, how you're giving them cues, how you're giving them kind of feel cues, the amount of information that you're giving them, how you're prioritizing technical things in the swing.
So Doc, let's go back to the recipe versus ingredients comment that you made.
Yeah.
A practical example. So we've got a high level player, say plus two or three college player, that's struggling with wedges, distance control wedges. So say 60 to 100 yards. So struggling with distance wedges, and we tell you he's got too much leg movement, which is causing him some tilt issues and some low point control issues. Okay. Mm-hmm. How do you, develop a plan for him?
All right, I'm going to give you a really specific example. So do you want to talk about the movement part of it first?
That's fine. But I want you to cover both. I want you to cover for our listeners at home. They've been given a task because they struggle with slice and driver. So they've been given a task to get more lead wrist flexion. And so how do we do skill development? How do we do technique development? Okay.
So let's start it out first. Let's talk about the lead wrist flexion, right? So that's the gymnastics part of it. The ingredients part of it is Shay saying to me, there's too much lead wrist flexion. And this is a high level player. And so what I'm doing is basically identifying all the characteristics of the player. And what's really important is that he's a high level player, because I wouldn't do this with a higher handicap player. But this is a specific example with a high level player. And then I'll go over an example with a higher handicap player. So the higher level player, if we're working on lead wrist flexion, I need to first find out what the ideal position, well, it's not a position because it's a dynamic movement, but we need to find out what that ideal flexion should be like, or wrist movement should be like, right? Once we find that out, then it's a matter of saying, okay, if the ideal wrist flexion in the swing is far off from what you're doing, let's create a baseline, a numbered baseline for where you are now. So if how much, I'll use percentages, and we talked about this. So do you have to have a 50% feel to get to the ideal, or is it a 20% feel, or is it a 30% or 15% feel? Higher level players, when we go through this task, it's usually like anything from 15% or below, right? So then I'll say, okay, try it out a little bit. And to get to the ideal, how much over, right? How much over of the movement do you have to do, or how intense does the movement have to be? And so let's say the player says 15%. So what I've done there is now I've calibrated their perception with reality. So I said, in order for you to get that proper lead rest flexion, you have to think about that you're doing it 15% more than you think you should be doing it, right? Which is, can be a lot for a high level player because their feels are so much more sensitive. And so that's our starting point. So now that, okay, now that you're at 15%, let's introduce some practice variability, right? Practice variability is the concept of doing things differently, even though that they're wrong, right? So in this particular application of practice variability, we're going to vary one thing, and the one thing is the amount of lead risk flexion. And we're going to start with the 15% because the 15% gets them to the ideal. So I'd say, okay, let's get to 15%, hit those a couple times. Now I want you to go to 20%, right? Then I'll have them hit 20%. And then they might hit 20% a couple times. And the amount of, and the amount of trials they do at 15, 20% in the sequence, it's kind of, it's at a high level, it's very dependent on player. So we won't jump into that so much right now. And then, so they, now they do it at 20%. So then I have them go the other way. And I say, now they have them do it at 10%. Now this is really important. When they go to 10%, they're actually going back towards the wrong way. Now people ask me, well, why would you want me to practice the wrong way, right? And so I always say, our nervous system is like a computer. It wants data points, right? It wants data. And if it has data and data points, it could distinguish what's right and what's wrong. But if you're always giving it one data point or one thing, it makes it a little bit harder for the nervous system to distinguish what's right and wrong. So I have to give the nervous system some information about what's wrong so it can better identify what's right. And so we might do one at 10%, and then we'll go back to the 15% over, and then we'll do some 20% over. And so that's how I might handle that once that, I mean, that's really like how, that's like one thing amongst thousands, right? And so you can think about it as, you know, people say periodization of strength. I say periodization of skill also, because this is over time. What are we doing over time to create movement change? And so this is just one thing. It may, for a player, they may spend 10 minutes on it. They may spend 30 minutes on it, or they may spend 20 minutes a day on it every single day for a month, right? But that's kind of how I train those sorts of things. And this is the thing that sucks, all right? I'm going to give you the thing that sucks, is what feels 15% for that player today to get the sit back to the same ideal lead risk flexion, tomorrow it could be 20%. Good players, and correct me if I'm wrong, Hal, they always are looking for a feel. Right? They always say, I'm searching for this feel, or it feels this here. That's totally fine if you understand that feel changes. Feel changes within the day, feel changes between days. And so what you need to do is be able to calibrate your feel, right? So what do you need today in order to get to the quote unquote ideal based on, man, you know, if you have, like, I lived in the South, I lived in the South for my PhD. And when it was crawfish season, and I would just kill, right? Like pounds of crawfish. That night and the next morning, think about my water retention, or my willingness, or my thirst for water, right? And that's the illustration of dietary, nutritional dietary variables can influence your feel, right? Probably an extreme one. Think about whether you have a heavy load of physical training and how that influences feel the next day. And so you have to, what the practice variability does, not only gives our nervous system additional data points to figure out what's right, but it also sets us up for how we want to approach the changing feel from day to day. And that's what you'll hear JD and I, John Dunnigan and I talk about. We're always trying to calibrate each day, right? So what's your baseline numbers in reality? and what is, how does that feel match up? And so the feel changes. It's fine that the feel changes as long as you're calibrated. What do you need for that specific day?
So go into skill development from a distance wedge standpoint. Like, how do you, the technique's okay, but technique overall is okay, but they're struggling. Strokes gained inside 100 yards, 60 to 100 yards is weak. How do you kind of design that plan?
Same level of player?
Yeah, good player. Doesn't have to be a tour player, but just a good solid player.
Yeah, so we'll say a good player. So a good player, I look at it as in two stages. And then one stage is the range setup, and then one stage is the course setup. So I always say for the range purposes, the range work will be largely, okay, let's calibrate, right? That's what the range is for. What do you need for 95 yards today? What is the feel for 95 yards today? Because it could be different from yesterday. So let's just calibrate that feel. And you can do it in a variety of ways, right? You've heard things like block practice, serial practice, random practice, mini block practice. You can do that any way you want for that range for this particular player, because it's not going to make a huge difference for that 15, 20 minute session. You'd probably want to stay away from a lot of doing the same thing over and over, right? Be a little bit more where you're changing the distances a little bit more for the higher end player. But that's not going to be the big difference maker. The big difference maker is the calibration of what they're doing on the range, and then how you're doing it when you get to the course. So I say for that player, calibrate your feels and your dissonances on the range. And then now we're going to practice on the course. And now we're in the world of scrimmage, right? So I'm going to take a particular scrimmage scenario. So if the wedge play is going to be the thing that we're going to focus on, let's say it could be 9 holes, 18 holes, 3 holes, whatever. But let's say it's the first 9 holes. We're going to focus on wedge play from 120 and in. I might say hit one driver shot, whatever you want. It's not a big deal. And then what you're going to do is you're going to go in the fairway, you're going to pick up your driver, and then you can just put balls at distances where you lose the most strokes to the field. Right. So in these days, that level player is going to have a lot of strokes gain data. And so those are ingredients for me from a skill standpoint. So if I know that, like, it could be very different, their yardage from their strokes gain from 120 to 110. So I'm not going to take the 120. I'm going to take the top three where they're losing the most strokes to the field within 120. And I'm going to say drop balls at each of those distances. Right. And then practice there. Move on to the next hole. You can putt if you want, like, putt one out just so we keep putting there. Go on to the next hole. The next hole, what you're going to do, hit same thing, tee shot, 3 balls, maybe one in the rough at that distance, one in the fairway at that distance, right? Maybe one in the primary rough at that distance. So for that level of player, that's the style of practice or the style of training that I would do with them, because that's going to be, it's going to be more effortful because it's a little bit more real world oriented. Reps are super important. So in this case, I get 3 reps, maybe then just maybe one if they were playing, like actually playing. You can even drop 5 depending on your course congestion setup, right? I'm always say baseline, more reps is better. Baseline, because I can work much easier with people with a lot of reps. That's why I don't say like, maybe some of your juniors, not your juniors, but sometimes people have juniors and they work with a group of them and they're trying to mimic the pacing of the course, of course play. So they'll go, oh, you never hit a ball right away. 2 seconds later, you wait, right? I think you have to be very careful with how you do that style of practice, because the downside of it is while they're waiting, they're not getting the reps that they need. So that gets back to the periodization of skill. If for that high level player, you need to be able to see, wow, it's coming closer to tournament day, how your practicing changes. So maybe the time between shots is going to be longer, but earlier in the week on Monday, you're hitting a lot more shots with a lot less time in between. Right. So looking at the competitive tournament schedule And it's really, it's kind of a pain for tour players, because if they're playing a lot of tour events right after one another, you basically have Monday, Tuesday, and then Wednesday's the pro-am. There are cool things you can do within a pro-am context, but you really only have Monday, Tuesday, and then what they're doing after the round. So it even becomes even more compressed. So how you focus on things during those times becomes a lot more critical, because the amount of practice is a little bit different. But if you have a college player, right, or a high school level player, competitive player, they're going to have a lot more days in between, right? So you can do a lot more things early on the week and then slowly change it where it becomes a little bit more tournament-like towards the tournament time.
If you have a guy that's calibrated on the range, so he can calibrate, say 90, 70, and 50 are his weaknesses. Yeah. And 90, 70, and 50 on the range, he's spot on.
Yeah.
TrackMan verified his calibration spot on. It doesn't take very long each day on the range to get it, but on the course he struggles. What's your go-to?
So the go-to is when he's on the range, and as soon as you've kind of seen it as a coach or the player has seen, like, I got this, like the 90, 70, 75 yardages, whatever. My thing is always get the hell out of there, right? Get off the range ASAP and get on the course. And my view, I don't know if I said this earlier, but scrimmage on the course is the bridge between the range and tournament play. Right. And so now he needs repetitions on the course. And that's why you have throw three balls down, five balls down, different spots. It could be the same spot depending on where they are. Now we need to make the course look more like the range. Right. And I don't mean like you throw a bucket of balls down, but what I mean is you're not going from, like, I was talking to one higher level player, is he'll say, I go, well, how's your practice on the course? And he'll say, oh, I always try to shoot the lowest score possible. And I say, well, that's good, because you have this really stringent goal, but you're denying yourself some valuable repetitions that you should be doing, right? With parts of your game that need more repetition. And so you just look at the part of your game that needs more repetition. And if you need to take more than one tee shot, you should be taking more than one tee shot if you can off the tee, right? And once again, you're constrained by the congestion of the course, but you do what you can in the context. So if the course is pretty open, right, I'd say hit three shots from each of those yardages at different angles to the hole with different lies, right? You can have rough, non-rough, ball below your feet, ball above your feet, uphill, downhill, like you have all those variations, but just get out there and hit multiple shots from all those variations from those yardages. And then, or you could do something, another approach would be, now I said scrimmage is limitless. It kind of depends on what it is that you're working on. It's really important. You could take the same yardage, right, and have them go to different parts of the green, right? That'll probably be less time consuming. And so that changes their sight lines. That might even change a little bit of how they're going to land the ball in the green, what the ball is doing, et cetera. So I think for that level of player, it's really finding the bridge between range and tournament play. And what I found that's really effective for high level players, that bridge is the scrimmage and how you're designing that scrimmage. Not always playing for score. I mean, I have the really high level players and who can, I mean, it takes a certain amount of personality to do this, but they're playing scrimmage in their scoring rounds. Right. I call it. Yeah. So it's even something like, that's like what I call super high level scrimmage, is they have specific goals. They're trying to shoot the lowest score, but their primary goal is something else. And so there's a variety of things that you could do with scrimmage. I think when look at the range performance as level one, check. What's level two? Right. Level two is a scrimmage context within the course that has a lot of repetitions.
So that was a lot to take in there. I think I have a question though.
Just jump in and stop me. Sometimes I ramble, Hal. So you could just jump in and stop me.
So is the recipe dependent on the ingredients?
It's dependent on the ingredients, and it's dependent upon the player's ability And it's dependent upon the player's schedule of time.
So the reason why I asked that question is there's a lot of things that have to come together there. And, you know, I totally agree with you that the range is, you know, you take a really good ball striker on the range from the same lie, from the same wind, from everything the same, in a few minutes, they're all going to look like Ben Hogan. They may not swing like Ben Hogan, but they're going to, the ball's going to be coming down and the caddy's going to be doing this right here.
Yeah.
But the golf course is a whole different environment than that. And I understand what you're saying. You've got to take this over to the golf course. How do you, I'm struggling here to put this into words. How do you tell which is wrong? Ingredients. I mean, you come up with a recipe.
Yeah.
So if the ingredients are wrong, is there a point that you can figure out, hey, we're doing the wrong thing here?
Oh, that's a really good point. So you have the swing movement part, right? And so that's not necessarily me. That's the coach. That's one thing. So I always say I'm swing agnostic. With some coaches, I could be a little, because of our relationship, I could be a little bit more opinionated, but pretty much I'm swing agnostic. I don't really care. But I always tell players this, if you're working on the wrong thing, I'm going to train that wrong thing into you really well, which is
dangerous. Well, that's what I'm asking right there.
Yeah, which is dangerous. So that's the technical side of things. And so I always leave that, you know, working in the team environment, the high performance team environments now, a lot of it is kind of knowing your space, right? And so what I do is for the swing technical part, I have an inherent trust, whether this be right or wrong, right? Both of you know way more about the swing than I do. I'm just going to assume, I just assume that you're correct, right? That's the approach that I take. So there could be a fault in that a small percentage of the time, but a high percentage of the time I'm going to be right because you guys know your stuff. Now there's the other side to it. And that this is, and I'm glad that you brought this up, is let's say the example that I gave Chase, I need to know if that scrimmage is working or not. Right. And so one of the things that is very important in my process is assessment. Assessment is very important because if you're not assessing, you're not evaluating what is working and what's not working. So if it's yardage, right, and they're still losing a lot of strokes to the field in the wedge yardages, I need to know that because then I can go back and review how they practice and modify and change based on there. Maybe the dose was too small and I need to give them a stronger dose. Or likewise, maybe the dose was too strong and I need to give them a smaller dose. But I only know that if I'm assessing. And there are multiple levels in which I can assess. Tour players, working with tour players is the best from assessments level because there's always shot link data and data has always been taken regardless of what their team statistician or strategist is taking, right? But I always look at the tournament data first and say, okay, is the change that we're making happening or not, right? And then I can look at practice data, and practice data becomes a little trickier because practice range data will fool you a lot because it's not the environment, as you mentioned. I can look at practice scrimmage data, right? Where it's a little bit range-like, or super high level scrimmage where it's just regular stroke play, but they have a goal that they're trying to execute. But even super high scrimmage play, correct me if I'm wrong, Hal, if you play a money game with your buddies, still very different from tournament play, right?
Right.
Even though you're playing for money and you're playing for the low score, it's still very different. And so that those training assessments are just data points that add to the complete picture. But I think you're really correct in pointing that out, is that when you're training and practicing, you got to make sure it's the right thing. So from a student's perspective, if you're a player out there, your decision to choose the right coach or the correct coach is very important. And then the other part of it is the assessment part of it. How you're assessing practice in tournaments, and then what are you doing to change what it is that you're doing to change those practice tournament numbers. So that's the approach that I go, is the gymnastic side. I have an inherent trust in the coaches. And on the skill side is I have benchmark numbers in the different parts of the development and competitive play that I look at to see if the doses are too strong or too weak, and I can change those.
So you're kind of dependent on the player to determine if the ingredients are wrong. If you've got to catch, if the ingredients are wrong, it's too late almost.
Yeah, correct. I have to determine. So my working dynamics change based on the player. Sometimes I just interface with a player, right? Sometimes my primary interface is with a coach, and the coach delivers to the players. And sometimes my interface is even with the coach and the player, right? So we'll take the example in which I have very little interaction with a coach. My preface is always this: you have to make sure that it's right, because it's not my job to make sure that the technical parts of the swing are right. Right? Because it's not. I mean, I got my PhD in motor control and learning, did a lot of work with athletes applying motor control and learning. I didn't do my PhD in the golf swing. Right. So what I do, what allows me to operate is to do my job. My job has to have good information right from the assembly line, so to speak. And that's kind of how I look at it, is my ingredients come from whomever the coach is. And I basically have that inherent trust that they're doing the right thing for their player.
I guess where I was going with that is it's always the player's responsibility to choose whether you're going the right direction or not.
Bam. The player is the CEO. They drive the train.
I said that? The player is always the CEO. Don't turn that responsibility over to someone else. Because, I mean, they can help. That someone else can help. You can help. Chase can help. I can help. But we can't do it for you. And you have to use your mind, your body, everything about it to reach the level that you want to reach.
Yeah. Let's put it this way. Me, you, and Chase are not hitting the shots.
Right.
That's exactly right. Doc, real quick, how long – you answered this for me when we talked a couple weeks ago, but how long does it take to change a motor pattern?
Well, I'm so glad you answered that. So as you recall in the SEA material, I have this module called BS filters. I always tell my students, I say, if you're sitting in your classes and you don't remember all the details, what you should be doing is at least developing your bullshit filters. So when you go out in the real world, you know when people are bullshitting you. Mm-hmm. If I always say that one BS filter, if someone says it takes X number of swings to learn something. The reason why I say that is because we don't have any evidence in the data right now, in the motor skill data, motor learning data, that says there's a specified amount of reps or time that you practice, right? Now it makes sense. It totally makes sense why there isn't. Because remember I talked about motor abilities earlier? It's what you get from your parents. People have differing motor abilities, for one. People have bigger things that they're working on in the swing than other people. So you have all those factors, right, that are contributing. Some people may say, oh, well, you look at Andreas Ericsson's work and you say 10,000 hours, like, is the minimum. We can kind of go on about what the general takeaway messages from that are. But if you're talking about saying lead wrist flexion, we need to improve, 10,000 hours doesn't fit the model. It doesn't fit that, right? So I always say, they say, how long is this going to take? And I say, the honest answer is, I don't know. because we don't know, right? It's dependent upon a lot of factors. It's like what Hal said, do you have the right ingredients, right? And what instructors are starting to do now is they're fitting how people's bodies move, right, to how their swing should be, right? You don't force something that the player can't physically do. And so imagine you're forcing a player to, not you guys, but imagine a coach is forcing a player to do something that they can't do, like movement-wise. How many reps is that going to take? Maybe their entire life. But let's imagine now a coach identifies something that they can do within their movement capabilities. How long does that take? Imagine a coach giving a cue that is internal in nature to a cue that's external in nature to another student, and imagine their differing rates, right? So there are too many things that play out that cause a differential in the number of, or the amount of time or the number of swings it takes to learn a movement pattern. You can't answer that question. It's really hard to do.
So Doc, I want to kind of, not wrap this up, but kind of end with some practical things that you gave us, as Hal said, you gave us a lot to grind on, but give us some practical things. I've written some notes down, but some practical things for our listeners to take away as far as how to practice, how to get better at this crazy game that we're all nutso trying to play the most difficult game in the world. But one of the things I wrote down, and one of the things that we've talked about and you talked about on skill coaching, was just being more precise about baseline. So what's ideal in the movement pattern you're trying to make? And then not being afraid. And this is one thing that Hal and I do a lot in here, is not being afraid of going too much either direction, exaggerating the previous bad one, going too far into lead wrist extension. Or if we're talking about wedge play and we've got somebody that has an overactive lower body, we're going to make them move even more, get more overactive with their lower body, and then don't move enough, and then kind of balance out that kind of Goldilocks theory, that Goldilocks approach that you guys talk about. Expand on that just a little bit. And that was one of the notes that I wrote down as far as just this practical approach to changing your motor pattern.
Yeah, I'd say if I were to give kind of like as a wrap up, like two things for players that they can do better with getting better at learning aspects of GALSA, I'd say one, think about the right thing. And when I say think about the right thing, it gets to the whole focus of attention literature, where you can think about your movements or you can think about the effects of your movements. So I would say think about the effects of your movements. So one of the things, instead of worrying about where your elbow is and da 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 da, all that stuff, maybe think a little bit more on club position or something along those lines. Think less about movements and more about the effects of the movements. So I think that will help a lot. So whether you have a coach that teaches that's super biomechanical, that'll help with. The other thing is, as you mentioned, practice variability, do things differently. For the higher level player, how they differ from ideal is going to be less from a higher handicap player, but just do things a little bit differently with the goal and concept that your foundation is the ideal part, right? So you could do three that are ideal and then do one that's not ideal. And this could be for yardage, right? Yardage with wedges, or this could be for improving movement. So think about things externally, think about it the right way while you're doing it, and add some variation within to what you're doing. Just don't try to do the same thing over and over again, because your nervous system needs data points. And if you give your nervous system data points, it's easier for it to choose the correct answer, right? If it has a variety of things that it can choose from.
And then I wrote down one more, and I want Hal's take on this. I put goals for tournaments or goals for scrimmaging isn't always lowest score. And how, what I would like your take on, like, how many times did you step on a golf course where your focus wasn't on shooting the lowest score?
So when it came to shooting a score and making money every day, my focus was on shooting a low score. Outside of that, it was never on shooting a low score, ever. I always was trying to create shots all the time. I hated shooting low in pro-ams. You know, they want you to try. The pro-am teams wanted you to. It's hard to duplicate. You go out there and shoot 63, it's hard to duplicate it the next day. So, and when I was at home, I never kept score, ever. Always had 2 and 3, 4 balls in my pocket. Like you said earlier, if I needed to hit 2 or 3 tee shots, I hit 2 or 3 tee shots. I always was trying to create an environment that I would expect to see in tournament golf. You don't ever see tournament golf on a practice tee. They just very rarely do you ever see that.
Yeah. One quick follow-up to that. Did you ever, like Tiger always talked about building up to majors, did you ever assess – like going into the final round of a regular tournament where you were in 35th place, were you ever using that round as Dr. Will talks about, like high level scrimmaging, like really going into a little bit more technique, like you wanted to accomplish something with your golf swing that day? Did you ever do any of that?
You know, I always felt like my golf swing, you know, I didn't feel like there was a nickel's worth of difference between a good shot and a bad shot. I didn't think we could describe the difference between the two. And, you know, it's hard to look at a golf swing like that. I think it's almost more internal than it is. You know, I was talking to someone that walked in here before we ever started the podcast. And I said, I can tell you, you know, too many people think technique has got to be really good. I would play 26 times a year. That's what I average playing a year. And I guarantee you, I didn't enter 2 or 3 tournaments where I felt like I was on the money. I still had to make something work. You know, I don't know. What do you think about that, Dr. Wood?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. One of the conversations I have with John Dunnigan a lot is we'll talk about method swings, right? Or swing coaches that profess that there's a one way to do it. And JD will always say, there's just one problem with that. And I'll go, what? And he'll go, the Hall of Fame.
Exactly.
Right? Because you got a problem with that. And then you can even look at it now, the top level player is not in all time of golf, but just within this time now. They swing very differently. And I love what you said about you hit different shots. Like that's practice variability right there, right? If you need confirmation to hit another shot, well, you just drop another ball on your course and you hit another shot, right? Those are the tenets of scrimmage where you're bridging the repetitive nature on the driving range. That's the advantage of the driving range, is you can explore, so you can hit a lot of shots in a short amount of time. That's really advantageous. Like, I don't want people to think I think the driving range is bad. I don't. The driving range has its time and its place. But I love how you illustrated how if you needed another shot, if you need another rep, you would take it and you took it on the course, right? Which is where it is. And then the different shot shapes, I think that lends really well. And then I think with social media and how people are consuming it, there's a little bit of overemphasis on what the swing looks like. And as you mentioned, it's what may look like a good swing could be two different outcomes.
Well, there's one data point we will never, ever be able to give somebody some sort of definition of, and that is the will to win. Yeah. That's a data point that we will never, ever be able to identify for someone. And people have different desires of that. But one thing that I will say, the more they work at it, the more their will to win is present. Okay. And so maybe we should close on something like that. You've been incredible. We appreciate you being on Be the Right Club today. I had to listen closely. A lot of it was pretty deep.
It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate you both having me on, and you know, I always have I always have good exchanges with Chase, and I'm just happy to be on and be able to share a little bit.
Thank you, Doc. Check out Skilled Coaching Alliance for you coaches at home. I've been a part of the program. It's awesome. Great stuff. John and Dr. Will are both awesome, awesome people. Great coaches, great mentors, great instructors. So thanks again, Doc, for having us on, and keep helping people practice better.
I'm trying my best.
Thank you.
Be the right club today. Yes!